Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 310.
This week on the podcast, breaking news, a major billionaire actually decides not to run for president.
Plus, now that ratings are what matter, the Democrats aim to produce the world's greatest reality debate.
And Democrats are finally making a controversial statement that bigotry is wrong. Related, puppies are cute.
Plus, a judge pleads with America to remember that Paul Manafort was a great man before his decades-long crime spree.
And Donald Trump, star of Presidency, Screen, softcore porn, and now Bible author extraordinaire.
We've got all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Ooh, that's right. And we're back on a Sunday.
We're back on a Sunday.
As promised.
As promised. Who knows how long this could possibly last, but...
Two weeks in a row?
You can count on us. We did Monday last week.
I know, but I mean like just consecutive weeks.
Consecutive weeks. I know. We're really...
Where one of them wasn't on a Thursday or there wasn't like just like a mystery two-week break for no particular reason in between.
Well, in the month of February, I rode on seven airplanes.
I know, right.
On three individual trips.
Yeah.
And in the month of March and forever, I have nothing planned. Forever.
Yeah.
The whole my whole life is ahead of me.
Yes.
So I'm going to have a lot of time to really dig into the political news.
Great.
Which was great this week because a lot of the news was on the presidential front, a bit of a change of pace in an
yes.
exciting way.
Right.
Because everyone announced this week that they weren't running for president.
Turned upside down.
It's like, what a world.
Yes.
First of all, I mean, let's just name some names because there were a lot of names out there and now a lot of those names are no longer names.
That's right.
We've got Bloomberg.
Michael Bloomberg. He's out. Wrote something on Bloomberg about how he would be better used by spending all of his money on causes.
So, I agree with him immensely. He was somebody I was actually most concerned about because I think he, more than anyone, had the power to sort of Ross Perot his way into that election in a way that was destructive.
Yeah.
And to also have...
Or Howard Schultz's way
into it. Exactly. To have so much money and, unlike Howard Schultz, enough experience campaigning that... I mean, I remember when he ran for that third term in New York and nobody wanted anyone to have a third term in New York. He blanketed the city with literature. I was getting phone calls from people asking if I wanted to volunteer with him. And I was like, I am a registered Democrat who has never voted for this man. You cannot be thinking that I'm going to volunteer for him.
Right.
I would get letters every day at my parents' house. Like, my parents were also getting the letters. But like, it was like the amount that he outspent his opponent in that, like 50-1 or whatever. And I was just like, I can't have a repeat of this.
Yeah.
I can't have Michael Bloomberg in the race. So we don't have to. Sherrod Brown. The first casualty of the Biden primary.
Yeah, and this was the this was the biggest shocker, I think, because he'd written a book, he's been on like a month long tour about like the, you know, promoting the decency of work, and like he was doing all the things that you do as sort of like a pre-presidential campaign, and so everybody just assumed that he was running.
Yeah. Well, and it seemed like the time.
And he
He's
also
a Midwestern
has been,
progressive. I mean.
Right. Well, that's the thing. And he seemed like the type of, I would not have voted for him in the primary, but he seemed like the type of person that like when it came down to sort of like the end and you were having to pick someone, and I'm not saying it would have been him because I don't think he's very exciting himself personally, but like that type of human is like who I think that it would be nice to have around because, A, he would be better than Biden in the Biden primary.
Right.
And you could see all wings of the party sort of, like, sucking it up and being like, all right.
Yeah.
Like, this seems like a reasonable enough choice that we can all just decide on and just, like, get behind.
He was somebody who is both moderate and progressive enough at the same time.
Right. He's from Ohio.
He's unfortunately super dull.
It's but more boring than almost anyone.
If you were the kind of candidate that was going to pick the world's most boring running mate, which many of these people are.
Yes, he's still out there.
He's out there and he's the right choice if you're that person.
Yes.
He's who Hillary Clinton should have picked. As
probably.
If she was going to pick boring white people.
Yeah.
He's the better boring white guy.
Yeah.
He's better than Tim Kaine. He's better than that genre of candidate.
Yeah.
Sherrod Brown is your ultimate VP pick if you are an exciting, splashy choice and you need someone who seems stodgy.
To lock down the boring person vote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Eric Holder, not running. I wasn't aware he was trying to, so that was news to me on both counts.
He's been hinting at it, I think.
But I mean, everyone's been hinting at it. Stacey Abrams is hinting at it. I mean, everyone's hinting at it. You know,
right.
Who isn't?
Yeah. So now, that's it. Three people not running for president.
Right. And one more person who Brent may have to remind me at least six more times is running for president.
Right. I told Lila that Jay Inslee was running for president in a text. And then later this week, you were like, wait, Jay Inslee's running for president? And I was like, yeah, I told you that.
Yeah,
and then
this bastard like, dug up the text.
I did.
To prove to me that he had told me. And I was like, I have no recollection of this whatsoever.
Right. And then later, you were like, oh, I'm getting an email from him every day.
Yeah.
So, okay. Like, you had been told on multiple fronts, like, on different, you know, platforms, like...
If Julia Brownlee has ruined anything for anyone, it's this. Because since Julia Brownlee found me, I have not even looked at the subject line of a single political email that I've received from any candidate. That includes candidates I love, like Bernie Sanders. That includes candidates I'm not that excited about, like random people in Florida that sometimes get me on their list.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that most certainly includes Jay Inslee, who, after Brent told me he was running for president, I dug through my inbox and discovered that he'd been emailing me every day to announce that he was planning to run for president, basically.
On a on climate change platform.
Yeah.
He's running on a single-issue candidate.
That's right. A single-issue candidate that you can't remember. In a field of 100 people, all of whom are more interesting than him, and all of whom are not named Jay Inslee.
Right.
And that is where
who also are probably near the same place that he is on climate change.
Correct. Right.
So that also makes that
I'm here for single-issue candidacy. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, I say go forward. That's another detail that Brent didn't forget to tell me in his initial text about this, but that I immediately didn't.
Oh, that's right.
I immediately forgot.
Yeah. That's okay.
So I've been having the daily opportunity to find out Jay Inslee is running for president for a while now, it turns out.
Yep.
And it never sticks. It's like Groundhog Day every day.
Yeah.
So two big questions remaining.
Two elephants in the room.
There's the Biden elephant.
The Biden elephant.
Who is is being presented as the Hillary Clinton of the race in the sense that despite the fact that he has not announced, news is also already telling us that he's the front runner.
Right.
There are all these polls being taken from God knows where.
Yep.
Polling God knows who.
Yeah.
Telling us that Joe Biden, a man who is currently not running for president and has, I hasten to remind everyone, failed to cinch the presidential nomination probably more times than any other person in modern history.
Yeah. And miserably, too.
Miserably.
Might we remind you? I mean,
just abysmal performances.
Well, there was just an article this week, and it was on Politico, about how the main concern that he may be struggling with, because supposedly he's been waffling about it. Like
that's what he did last time, and then he waffled away.
Is that there's concern about where he's going to raise money from.
Yeah,
like, and
rightfully
this was a problem in 2008. He quit right after the Iowa caucus, after he underperformed. He raised about half of the amount of money that he claimed at the beginning of the 2008 candidacy he thought he was going to need to raise leading up to that. He doesn't really have, you know, Obama was a huge fundraiser, obviously, but he doesn't have his own network of, you know, he doesn't have the email. He might have the Obama email list. I don't know. But I mean, like, he's not a person who can just jump into the race and then have like a bunch of money thrown at him other than from big donors, which a lot of the people in this race have sworn off. So it's not going to be a cute look for him if the only money that he's getting is from a super PAC that is being funded by God knows who.
Well, and it's a really bad look, especially when, you know, this is now something we're sort of focused on, we're paying attention to, but it's a really bad look when those same rich donors, their line with him is going to be, but he's the only one who's electable.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to be like, where are his supporters then?
Well, right.
Why does Bernie Sanders have, you know, millions of people donating money to him in a country where no one has any fucking money anymore? But Joe Biden can't find the donors. Like, you're not electable if no one votes for you.
Yeah.
And their only line, you know, with Hillary Clinton, they sort of had a little bit of both. So they were able to make the argument that she was kind of the right compromise.
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to do that with him.
Yeah.
He's not going to get the grassroots energy that Obama did because he's not as exciting a candidate as Obama.
No.
He gets people in the Beltway, like, really hot and bothered.
Right.
Like, the people in the Beltway get really worked up
about it. I mean, he's proven himself to be a poor presidential candidate twice.
Yeah. And
in different generations.
I was going to say over the course of decades.
Exactly.
And then the other big question is Beto.
Yes.
I would contend that the longer he waits, the less of a big question this is for me.
Well, I think so too. And I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he ran. But I, you know, one of the things that I was going to say is there's some other concern amongst the sort of Biden fans that the longer he waits, the more support gets solidified among the other candidates. Because, yes, it is still early, but there's so many other candidates. And also, because there's so many other candidates, these candidates are having to staff up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember reading the story, and there was, like, a quote from somebody in South Carolina who was just like, we've got people down who are here who would probably work on his campaign, but are also...
like, need a job.
Need a job. And, like, there's a million people running right now who are trying to have a freaking staff so they can, you know, compete in this primary down here. So, and that is the, so you're seeing sort of like some, and there's movement already because, yes, polls this early are stupid. Like, correct. We can both acknowledge that. But, you know, CNN just recently did a poll in Iowa, and it has 20, this was just last week, and it has Biden and Bernie, Biden has 25, and or Biden has 27, and Bernie has 25. So they're basically tied, which is sort of like, okay, well, who gives a rip? But the problem is that when they took the same poll in December, Bernie had 12%.
Yeah.
So he's more than doubled his support, while Biden's had stayed pretty stagnant. And also, a lot of the public polling that you're seeing has dipped, because people always include Beto in public polls. Ever since November, which is when he was the hot commodity, he has been continually slipping. So I don't know why he didn't announce quickly. It seems odd to me that he just wasn't
an identity crisis,
right out with that. I know.
It has nothing to do with
I know, he's having to have a lot of moody Instagram posts and, like, show,
like,
people
his
dental work.
Surgery
and it's
like, and
shit. Yeah, so I think it's...
he becomes less credible the longer this goes on. And then...
right.
Also,
so both of them are doing it wrong right now.
When his also, his fundraising is not going to look as impressive next to Bernie Sanders as it did next to Ted Cruz.
No, and that's the other thing, too. He was, this is what I, and maybe this, maybe he does understand this.
Yeah.
I don't know him well enough to know how he
what
reads,
he understands.
The, what he read, right, or what, you know, political wins he's able to read. But, like, I have always thought that the reason that everybody loved him, and yes, he did give a good speech, and he had, like, some very viral moments, and I think he had a pretty good understanding about sort of, like, race issues in this country, because people were asking him about, you know, kneeling during football games and various things, and, like, he gets
stuff.
Some things,
yeah,
you know, and can explain them in a way. But, like, the reason that people were throwing money at him, like he was a stripper,
right,
was because he was running against Ted Cruz.
Right.
And it looked like there was maybe a chance in hell that he could
win.
That he could win that. And he almost did. And that would have been great. But, like, being not Ted Cruz is different than being one of 13 other people running in a primary of your peers.
Right. And also, when you, as a, in a Texas general election, your platform can be sort of comparatively vague. You can say some stuff about single-payer healthcare, whatever. You don't really need to flesh out what your ideas are because, in contrast, we're talking about Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
This is different also, and this is why I keep saying the most exciting candidate in this race is Liz Warren, because she has ideas. It doesn't even matter how she's polling. She just keeps challenging them with policies, with specifics, and we're going
to
get to some of that.
Yeah.
But when you have... you know, idea havers in a race, and then a bunch of people that are trying not to have ideas in opposition to those idea havers that are having to stake out more specific non-ideas.
Or having ideas, but not knowing what they mean.
What they are, exactly. Right. Like, that is a hard place for somebody who was able to last run about, you know, run on the left of Ted Cruz, you know, to be in. Because where does he fit into this? I don't even know. You know, is he in the Biden? I mean, he's in the flashy person primary.
That's what there, like, was actually a...
he's pretty conservative.
And I didn't even read the whole thing because I was... I'm mostly disinterested in him, if I'm being honest. But there was an article on Politico this week that, like, the headline was like, what does Beto actually think?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he may think nothing. It wouldn't surprise me if he thinks nothing.
No. Me either. I think he's a candidate who seemed, you know, people who aren't super into politics and therefore don't dig into policy the way we do really liked him because he's so charismatic. And Brent and I can admit that he's charismatic. We're not...
sure.
We have eyes.
Look, I donated to him.
Yeah.
I wanted him to beat Ted Cruz.
Right, exactly.
Like, I still get his emails because I was silly enough to write him a damn check.
We went
check.
To fundraisers
we
for
went
him.
To, right.
You know,
I mean, that, so I
but,
get it. But it's like not...
but
I
this,
got... I that, I always just say, I'm like, I had use for him running in a race against Ted Cruz. And I don't anymore.
No,
I have no
exactly.
use for him any longer.
No, exactly.
And I think that he's going to find that that is going to be the case.
Yeah.
And maybe he has already found that. And that is
well,
what's
say,
taking him so long.
Especially with the kind of people that are engaged in early primary stuff. Because that's the other thing is he was the candidate running against Ted Cruz in Texas. So that, you know, you were sort of able to focus on that even if you weren't somebody who was following that race from the beginning.
Right.
Whereas this is very early in the primary process and there's already 6 million people running. And people who are engaged in primary politics will have a sense of what he does or does not offer and whether it's something that another candidate could offer better.
Right.
And that wasn't going to be the case when everyone found out about him, you know, in the midterms. Everyone right. comes to the midterms pretty late because
yeah.
it's true. You know,
yeah, yeah.
The midterms just don't start out this early on.
Yeah.
In any case, moving on, speaking of a trillion people running for president.
Yeah.
The greatest slash worst slash most genius slash least genius
yeah.
idea to be had by the DNC in decades.
I know.
In a generation.
Well, it was
being had.
It was well-intentioned.
It's certainly well-intentioned. Because listen, I want to say before we begin, I'm 100% for it.
Oh yeah, I'm not mad at it.
No.
At all. But
you might be, listener, yeah, mad at it. But,
right. I mean, just
it plays right into me and Brent's hand. It might not right. be your cup of tea.
Yeah, exactly. So remember how, well, the 2016 debates were not great.
Not great.
You'll remember there were a lot of issues. Bernie took a lot of issues. So did Martin O'Malley take a lot of issues. They sort of tried to hide them all on a Saturday night and not have any of them and whatever.
And they kept having town halls that were more interesting than the debates.
Right. And so anyway, the DNC is sort of like wanted to have like a little bit of a sense of fairness going into the debates. Also, seeing probably the writing on the wall that there were going to be a lot of people running, even though it was, you know, a while ago when they made these rules, they just probably assumed that everybody was going to probably try and,
right.
you know, run take a run for president. Anyway, so they passed this, like, they've got these rules on how that you're going to be able to qualify to be part of the debate. Because you remember the Republican debates in 2016,
I ever.
Which were a damn dream. I mean,
the
they
Republican
were
debates in 2012 were a damn dream. 2016 one-upped them. In
yeah.
2012 is when we started this podcast, and we started this podcast because of the Republican debates.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
We started it the day of the Rush yes. Limbaugh, or the week of the Rush Limbaugh Sandra Bland comments. But the reason that we thought to start this podcast
yeah.
was because of the Republican field in 2012.
Yeah, that's right.
2016 took that field, and
right.
you know, and that was a field with Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann and like all of these
oh,
genius
yeah.
characters.
yeah,
and then Donald Trump. Showed
yeah.
up in 2016.
That's right.
And that was like
Ted Cruz,
Marco Rubio,
Carly Fiorina,
Dry Mouth, Marco Rubio, Lego
yeah,
Head,
Lindsey Graham.
I mean,
yeah.
there were so many greats.
Yeah.
And so what we're looking at now
is
potentially
our,
a Democratic
is
version
our
of
own
it.
Version of that.
Yes.
But so they decided that they would try and put some limitations on who was going to be able to get into these debates. But the problem is they might have made them too lax.
Okay.
Because here are the two things that can get you qualified. Yeah. Candidates must be must get at least 1% support in 3 party-approved public polls, or, and here's the biggie, here's the or,
yeah.
or received campaign donations from 65,000 individuals with a minimum of 200 donors apiece in 20 states. So we have 2 candidates who are running right now who you may or may not have heard of.
Right.
One is Andrew Yang, who's right. like a business person, venture capitalist, and he's running solely on a universal basic income platform.
Right.
And then you have Marianne Williamson, who is a new age guru who is running on a platform of like being hippy-dippy and nice to everyone.
Right. And if you live in Southern California, you're very familiar with her.
Right, because she's ran for Congress here before, right. and also she's been teaching A Course in Miracles
Correct.
For decades.
Right.
At like
and
big
if you
theaters around
live
town.
Anywhere else, you may never have heard this
you,
name.
If you live in Los Angeles, you have an annoying friend who has posted about,
nonstop
about Marianne Williamson.
Yeah. That friend
anyway,
might have a suspect job.
That's right. It looks for all the world like both of those two are going to meet the 65,000 individual donors threshold
yeah.
and then be on
I can't
the,
say enough good things about
the debate stage.
And yes. I'll tell you why. I have a good reason for it.
Yeah.
The rent is too damn high parties, Jimmy McMillan.
Yeah.
Is basically one of these kind of characters.
Yeah.
He was a single issue candidate who was not a credible candidate and was just came into debates and said,
yep.
the rent is too damn high. And he was right. and the rent is too damn high. But they had to talk about rent for fucking hours at those debates, basically,
right.
because of him. I'm all in if Andrew Yang, a nonsense person, wants
yeah,
to show up.
His platform is to give everybody $1,000 every month.
Yeah. If he wants to show up and tell us that we all get $1,000 and explain why that's the right choice, I am here for it. If Marianne Williamson wants to get up and tell us we should all be nice to each other, well, that's not a policy suggestion. I think it's true, you know? Right, I don't know that I necessarily buy into the miracle aspect of her ideology, but I mean, like, I am here for people having the ability to get into a debate on a single issue candidacy, because I love single issue candidacies.
Yeah.
There's nothing I love more.
Yeah. And the other thing is that they wanted to, they didn't want to do it like the Republican. They wanted some fairness, unlike the Republican debates, which sort of like had the undercard
debate. The Pee Wee League debate.
So supposedly, at least for the first two debates, it's going to be random. So you could be seeing Marianne Williamson at this debate telling Joe Biden that he needs to be nicer to everyone.
Yeah.
And which is just that's cuckoo bananas.
But it's also genius because I think, and it's, I don't know why they agreed to this, because this is really, I think, I have a theory actually, which is that I think that to them, the idea of getting 65,000 donors was so bananas because they were so used to just rich people donating and no one else, that it didn't occur to them that, like, you know, many of the leading candidates in this race have like hundreds of thousands of donors and in states and around the world.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't occur to them that for a grassroots candidacy, that's like a pretty respectable but not unachievable number. It's hard when you're Joe Biden.
Sure.
You know,
right.
To get a reasonable number of donors to donate.
Right.
It's certainly like, it's certainly harder when you're a big ticket candidate who only Wall Street cares about.
Right.
But it's not that hard for smaller candidates to get this kind of, you know, action.
And especially when you have, at least Marianne Williamson.
She has a following.
She has such a, she has a huge like base of not necessarily political base, but like people who would give her a dime to see her on television.
Obviously.
I mean,
No, I think that also though, my big frustration with doing undercard debates is that, you know, part of the initial primary process should be weeding out what ideas we want to focus on.
Right.
And when you have an undercard debate, you eliminate the scope of ideas that are even sort of worth discussing. And so people don't become familiar with them.
Right.
I think that the first couple debates should be literally any Looney Tune who wants to be on stage, as long as they have a following and a platform, because that means maybe everyone's in favor of universal basic income and no one fucking knows what it is.
Well, and that's the other thing, too, because like I...
how many people are in favor of single-payer healthcare now who had never heard of it 4 years
ago? Well, and I wholeheartedly agree, because not only that, besides the fact that like, yes, we should be weeding out those ideas, but like who is to say that if both... Andrew Yang and John Hickenlooper have 0% in the latest poll, that they shouldn't be treated the same way on a debate stage. I realize John Hickenlooper was the governor of Colorado, but if nobody likes him, then who gives a rip?
Exactly. No, you know, that's, I mean, who's this? Kirsten Gillibrand's polling at negative 0%.
Yes.
She has tons of money. It's like the problem isn't money.
Right.
And the problem isn't that she's not a credible candidate, because she's a senator and a successful one at that.
Right. From a large state.
From a large state and from, you know, and has legislative, you know,
wins
under her belt.
Point to things that she's done.
But if no one's going to vote for her, then is she really a different candidate than any Joe Schmo who has a following?
Right.
And should she be treated as such?
No.
Just because she has money?
Yeah.
And that's what I think they're getting at here. It's the idea, they used to decide your credibility on the basis of how much money you made, but the money's fake.
Or you could raise, exactly.
The money is fake. And the idea, the party is supposed to help you raise the money once you're the candidate.
Right.
It's not supposed to be that it's your responsibility to have deep pockets, but then the party is like, well, we can't do anything about it. We have to find someone who Wall Street loves, because we can't, like, that's where the party is supposed to step in when the people pick a candidate to help figure out how to fund the damn thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the idea that for this many years, or for so many years, we've been letting Lincoln Chafee into presidential debates, but like Marianne Williamson, a fake person for sure, but like can't come too, is like, what on what grounds was Lincoln Chafee, a man who only raised $30,000 of his own money in a presidential debate?
I know.
But like Rocco Laforte, whatever that guy is who runs in certain states, or, you know, Evan McMillan on the Republican side, like why weren't any of them in debates?
Yeah.
You know?
Totally. Yeah. It's funny, Andrew Yang, if you go to his website, it has like a little animation of him like inching towards a debate stage podium, like with a ticker of like how many individual donations he has.
He's close, you guys.
I was gonna I looked earlier today and he was like just shy of 60,000. You have to have 65.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
he'll get there, because there's not debates until the summer, I don't think.
No,
so,
exactly. I'm an amount in that can't really even be adequately described to this whole thing. I mean, I hope someone really surprising shows up there too.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who is running that could really be, you know, get in. I mean, plenty of people.
Right.
There's always, because you forget about the regional candidacies. There are candidates that are only on the ballots in certain states.
Yeah.
That are sort of protest but candidacies.
Some of those donations have to be
from 20 states.
There was the 20 states, which is not that many ultimately.
No, and also if you knew that was your goal, then you run in 20 states. You don't be an idiot. Right, yeah. You know. In any case.
Yeah.
I couldn't be more excited.
Yeah.
And then
on that debate stage, the person who was going to be able to
talk about things
so far is Elizabeth Warren. And we sort of knew that would be the case, but she's proving us right.
She's continuing to come up with policy ideas and then details about how she would implement them that are far and away more detailed than anything anyone else has come up with. So, and I love her strategy because her strategy is to say something super bombastic so that the headline is super bombastic.
Yeah.
And then the article has to explain why it's actually super reasonable.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think that, and this so far is that, and I think that because Bernie is trying to run sort of like a more standard campaign this time, I think that he's probably going to have to do some more policy papers than he has in the past. But that's the difference between the two of them right now, is that, you know, a lot of their platform is not so different. But you're right. Elizabeth Warren will say, like, oh, I'm going to break up the tech companies. And then everybody's like, oh, well, Elizabeth Warren is crazy. And then she's like, well, here's this paper I wrote about it.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, this seems pretty practical, actually. Right. We should break up the, like, that's, well, that's what I've always said she offers.
Yeah.
She's the person who can say the same thing as Bernie Sanders, but explain to you why you want it too.
Right. Yes. And how it's going to work.
And how it's going to work. And she's a person who can also explain to the people it affects how it's going to work.
Right.
And how it's not going to ruin their lives.
Right.
You know, I mean, they'll complain, like, they'll bitch and moan like it's going to ruin their lives. But is breaking up big tech companies going to cause Mark Zuckerberg to go hungry?
No.
He's still going to be a very rich man.
Yeah.
So, like, that's what I think she offers. And so she's been saying, I'm sick of freeloading billionaires, which is my favorite thing that people are saying right now. Yeah. I love how we're all anti-billionaire now. I've been waiting for us to be anti-billionaire for a long time.
It's great.
Because as we've explained in multiple former podcasts, the economy is fake.
Yes.
And billionaires are made by us. We don't have to let them be billionaires.
They're just hoarding money.
We made up the monetary system.
Yeah.
And they're hoarding it. So she has laid out a proposal this week calling for regulators to undo some tech mergers.
Yep.
And then she would she's proposing legislation that would prohibit platforms from offering a marketplace for commerce and participating in that marketplace. So she's talking about Amazon. She's talking about things like Facebook and Google and Apple.
Yep.
She's talking about breaking up certain entities within those, like Amazon Marketplace versus Amazon Basics, because that is essentially a monopoly.
Yep.
You know, that's a vertical company that, you know, is where they're producing the thing that they're selling.
Yep. It would also roll back some acquisitions that some of the tech giants have, like including like Facebook when they purchased them, WhatsApp and Instagram, and then Amazon's addition of Whole Foods.
Right. Waze
Google's
for Google.
Purchase of Waze. Yeah.
And she basically, you know, she said, she posted something on Medium on Friday that basically talks about how, you know, these, and we just saw this in New York, these companies are so powerful that they can bully taxpayers into doing their bidding.
Yeah, I think she announced this in New York, actually.
Yeah, well, she should. I mean, because that's a big controversy that's happening in New York. And I know there's a lot of sort of people pulling their hair about it in New York on the government level, being like, oh, how did this fall apart? This was going to be good for whatever. This was going to be bad forever. I think the problem that everyone realized too late was that no one had made a case to taxpayers that this was worth their investment.
Yeah.
And basically what she is saying is that, you know, companies should not be able to, well, in the words of Mark Zuckerberg, act more like a government than a traditional company. They shouldn't be able to make deals at the government level to deal with taxpayers and bully taxpayers as if they are sort of like, you know, they are a government entity. And that's what Amazon was doing in New York.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of these companies are doing in the places where they're headquartered or even outside of places that they're headquartered where, you know, they become sort of like their own proxy government for themselves for an entity that doesn't exist.
Right.
It's just an idea, basically.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And are able to sort of like, because they're so large, are able to bully governments into doing their bidding without it being in the interest of taxpayers necessarily, or without anyone having to even think about what's in the interest of taxpayers. You know, Amazon's able to just pull out when the thing, when they're forced to explain why this is good for taxpayers. They're just like, oh no, we're not going to.
Well,
goodbye.
And they're also, I mean, the whole point of this too, and you, she had some quote. You know, she's been talking a lot about like how she is still a capitalist, because there's been a lot of discussion about whether you're a democratic socialist or whether you're this or that or whatever. And she likes to talk about how she's a capitalist. And she, I think there was some quote in this article too, and I didn't pull it, but basically where she was just like, this will actually allow for more competition.
Right.
Because right now they're just, is it, they've, they've sort of just sucked up all the oxygen.
Yeah.
And like there's no room for any competition.
We've been
like,
down this road before as a country. I mean, we work in an industry right now that got broken up in antitrust cases because when theaters not only owned the studios and owned the theaters that were going to play the things, you know, when studios owned the means of distribution,
yeah,
that was a monopoly. It meant that you weren't able to negotiate in good faith with them because they owned the entire means of production. And so they were able to be really, you know, unscrupulous with the way that they practice their business, and they were broken up. And that is why it's, you know, if you work outside the entertainment industry, you probably don't realize that 20th Century Fox, well, was different than Fox, you know, the broadcast, you know, Fox, the network is different than Fox News is different. And, you know, we're starting to see those companies suck themselves back up again.
Yes.
You know, a lot of these companies are back up, but that was why.
Well, and merging with each other.
And merging with each other
Fox
again.
And Disney. But, you talk about Fox, they're merging with Disney right now.
We have had this problem with other industries. Didn't we have this problem with the railroads at some point? And, you
probably.
Know, like antitrust laws came into effect because in the 20s, during, you know, at the beginning of the Great Depression, in the 30s too, like, you were seeing entities suck up smaller entities so that they owned an entire vertical, basically, of an industry. And it meant that people were not empowered to go into competition with them because they could shut down any competition because they owned everything.
Yeah.
And that is something that we have at times in history had to learn that we need to contend with.
Right.
You know, we've had to do something about that before in history. And she's basically just saying,
we're back in that period. Right.
We're back in another period where, you know, when you hear about these big mergers that go on with telecom companies or go on in entertainment or whatever, that's what we're talking about, is we're talking about the very changes that led to our antitrust laws. And there was a reason that we had to pass antitrust laws.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just because companies always act in the most scrupulous ways.
Right. Shocking.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, so the Democrats did do one thing this week.
They did.
They passed H.R. 1.
Yeah.
So we...
They passed something else, too. We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. That was what most of us talked about all week. But the big exciting news of the week is that we passed that big, you know, election reform package that they were talking
about. That's what they passed on Friday after a week of some drama. So we're going to focus on the success on Friday before we get to the drama.
And we've talked about H.R. 1 before.
Yeah. I mean, they announced early... and often that this was going to be the first thing that they were going to do as soon as they were able to get it together. And
they passed on straight party lines.
Straight party lines.
We are. The Republicans do not want you to vote, and they do.
Yeah, exactly. It's a long bill. I mean, it really gets to the heart of a lot of issues. Yeah, it really is. It's 500 pages.
Right.
But it does a lot of things. It would require states to offer automatic voter registration. It would make Election Day a federal holiday. It would institute independent redistricting. Redistricting commissions.
To me, the most important thing in the world.
Totally, yep. So that would end partisan gerrymandering. It would also require nonprofit organizations to disclose their large donors, which basically, like, aims to get rid of dark money, which are funding political campaigns.
Right.
It also directs the sitting president and vice president, as well as candidates for the presidency and vice presidency, to release their tax returns.
Right. So it was great, and it only occurred after a full week of them fighting over more comments by Ilhan Omar. We talked about her previous comments.
Yes.
And she made comments about the comments that then re-incensed everyone. And now we're back. So here's what we did accomplish out of all of this.
Yes.
You guys, they passed a resolution condemning bigotry of all kinds.
Right.
We're against bigotry.
Which is not what it initially was.
No.
Because initially it was about anti-Semitism.
But the reason it was about anti-Semitism was because Ilhan Omar had been talking about the Israel lobby, which, by the way, is not the same thing as the Jewish people. We talked about this maybe last week or the week before on the podcast.
The week before,
Where she had made a comment that got interpreted as anti-Semitic because it referred to the money coming out of the Israel lobby. And
she said it's all about the Benjamins, baby.
Right. And so then they were, you know, people were up in arms. And then she made some comments to clarify it. That clarified it less, because she said, I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. I want to ask why it's okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA or fossil fuel industries or big pharma and not talk about a powerful lobbying group that is influencing policies. Apparently, you're not allowed to call a lobbying group that influences policies a lobbying group if it's an Israel lobbying group.
That's right.
And I want to once again clarify that the Israel lobby is not the lobby for the Jewish people.
Right.
It is a lobby that focuses exclusively on the state of Israel and sort of blind support for Israeli foreign policy that is often discriminatory towards other people.
Right.
And that is why she has problems with it. There were plenty of Jewish groups that came out and were like,
I was gonna say,
what is the problem here?
I was going to say, and really what she's talking about here, and this is what we said on the last time that we talked about it, she's talking about campaign finance is really what she's talking about here. I mean,
and when she's talking about how our foreign policy is being affected by a lobby that is not necessarily in the interest of the American people as a whole.
Sure.
And she's right about that.
Yeah. So anyway, people jumped on that immediately and they were like, you're playing into more anti-Semitic tropes about money and power. And it was sort of like, I was talking about money and power,
In a context where the issue is literally about money and power,
right?
Which is an okay time to talk about it. One of the times, it's okay to talk about it. So then they wanted to pass an anti-Semitism resolution, which was not an anti-Semitism resolution because it was actually just basically a condemnation.
Yes.
And that is why when it sounded in the news like there were people against an anti-Semitism resolution. What they were actually against was a petty resolution aimed at reprimanding someone for rightly calling out the power of a lobbying organization that puts a huge amount of money into both parties in every level of government.
Yeah.
Because we are not talking about, certainly the Israel lobby gives a lot of money. You know, AIPAC gives money to the Democrats.
Oh, but they give a lot of money to Republicans.
They are not the only people getting money from AIPAC.
No, not even at all.
So this is one issue where it is almost that people in government are representing a different cause than people. You know, like, they're taking money from an organization and they're united in this. Both sides are taking money from this, you know, from this lobby. And it is causing them to not always act in the interests of the people. Because it is not the same thing to be rabidly pro-Israel as it is to be in favor of the safety and respect for Jewish people worldwide.
Right.
And it is certainly often the same thing as being wildly Islamophobic to be rabidly in support of Israeli foreign policy as it is currently being conducted. Because there is a difference between Israel conducting itself in a respectful manner towards the people on its border.
Yes.
Or inside of its borders and what Israel is doing right now.
Well, and that's the other thing, too. I think a lot of people saw this for what it was, and that's how it ended up being a broad measure. Because a lot of people came out and were immediately like, are you seeing this as anti-Semitic because a Muslim woman said it?
And that's why they were seeing it that
way. And yes, was the answer sort of that I think a lot of people came to. Yeah. And this really did, I think when they initially announced that they were going to put this measure forth, they were surprised at the backlash.
Yeah.
Because this conversation is changing a little bit slowly.
It's nuanced too. You know, and I think they had been not worried about the nuance before because no one was paying attention to the nuance.
Right, and they were like, let's just shut this freshman up.
Right.
And
everyone was not what you're doing.
Right.
Here.
It did not go over well.
No.
The presidential candidates
had to weigh in.
Bernie weighed in, which is not surprising because this is an issue that he has talked about before. But Kamala Harris weighed in and said that she supported Ilhan Omar.
Kirsten Gillibrand's in favor of everyone.
She sort of both-sided the whole situation. Yeah. But,
she's the New York Congress. That was a tough spot for her.
But also just like, maybe don't say anything. I mean,
Coming from New York, she couldn't comment.
Okay, right.
She had to both sides. I mean, she didn't have to both sides it. Because the right answer, in my opinion, was one answer that was not a both sides answer.
Sure.
But she did in the sense that I understand that the political pressures would have forced her to make a comment about it.
But it did sort of like lead to an interesting place because then they just basically changed it to be broadly about hate.
Well, and
or bigotry. But then it was hilarious though because the 23 people voted against it and they were all Republicans and they were like, no, we just wanted it to be about anti-Semitism, which is freaking rich. They could have passed that resolution any time over the past 2 years in regards to their own president.
I was going to say, maybe after Charlottesville protesters or Charlottesville marchers were shouting, "Jew will not replace us," would have been a time to do that.
Right, sure.
Didn't seem to be in a rush then.
After their president said that there were good people on that side.
That's a time to worry about anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
A time when you're trying to shut up a Muslim woman who's talking about a political event that affects Muslim people worldwide. By the way, or a political ideology that affects Muslim people worldwide is not the same thing.
Yeah. So, anyway, Steve King voted present, by the way.
Steve King, who censured himself earlier this year. I mean, I don't know what's going on with Steve King. In other controversial news, Paul Manafort got a sentencing this week that just sort of distilled what it is to have different expectations of
That's right.
rich white people when yes. they are on trial.
Yeah.
Because he got a sentence for one of the 6 billion things he's being yeah. accused of. You know, there's 1,000 cases against him. This is not the
well,
only
that's
case.
The other thing. And I've been reminding people that. That doesn't make this sentencing any less ridiculous and right. terrible. But, like, there's
more chances.
In various different, you know, in the District of New York and federal cases and this and that. I mean,
he's named in literally every case that has right. anything to do with anything.
He could still end up in jail forever.
The man's been acting as a foreign agent for his whole life.
Right.
but so a judge in a case that in the case Judge T.S. Eliot III, Ellis III, not T.S. Eliot III,
yeah, sure.
not you the know, author.
It's an easy mistake.
Sentenced him to just 47 months for a case where the recommended term for somebody who committed the crimes that he was accused of yeah. is 19 to 24 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, those.
Well, it's not like he was doing anything terrible, like selling marijuana or voting when he didn't realize that
his voting rights hadn't been. Stealing $100 out of a laundry room, which is right. One guy got this. There's a lawyer who tweeted that his client had just gotten 19 to 24 years, like something in that, for stealing $100
from, from a
laundry
yeah,
room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's already been credited. He might get credit for the 9 months he's already spent in jail. Plus, there is a break. There was just a break included in a sentencing law that Congress just approved that could allow him to serve this in just 22 months. That's under 2 years, you guys.
Yeah.
So here's what the judge had to say about all of us disappointed types who thought maybe that, you know, a decades-long multi-million-dollar fraud scheme could generate a larger punishment than under 4 years. He said, go and spend a day in the jail or penitentiary of the federal government. Spend a week there. He has to spend 47 months.
Mm.
Oh, poor Manafort.
Yes.
But he also said of Manafort, he's lived an otherwise blameless life. And he's also earned the admiration of a number of people.
Oh.
That's a hilarious thing to say about a man who is on trial for this many things at once.
A lot of people lived a blameless life
until they committed a crime.
Until they murdered somebody.
I mean, exactly. That's once you have committed your first crime,
then you're.
That's the first time that you haven't led a blameless life. Like you lead a blameless life until you don't.
Right.
And in his case, he did until he spent decades
right.
committing bank fraud
right.
and working for a foreign power and breaking a zillion kinds of other financial laws
yeah.
and tax evasions. I mean, this man has been at it for decades.
Yeah. No, he has.
But he's lived an otherwise blameless life, Brent. So
yeah.
I don't know why we would want to.
Right. Until he became a hardened criminal.
Right. I guess Judge Ellis had not heard about the fact that Manafort he's on trial for more than this, like we said. He's already admitted to 10 other felonies in other cases.
Yeah.
He has a related case going on the Washington District Court, and he has admitted to 10 felonies, including bank fraud, which was one of the high, you know, the reason the sentencing is so high for cases like him is because he committed bank fraud on two counts. But of those 10 other felonies, there's even more bank fraud. But somehow, we don't want to send him away for too long. That would be unfair.
Yeah.
So a lot of legal experts say sentencing guidelines are unduly punitive. but most criminal cases do follow them. 4 out of 5 follow them with either the guidelines themselves or send people to jail for even longer, unless the government specifically requests otherwise. And in Paul Manafort's case, the prosecutors hadn't respected or recommended a specific punishment, but they said that the range of 19 to 24 years was rightly calculated. So they kind of like tipped their hat to the idea
right.
that might have been the right range to go with.
Yeah.
But
yikes.
Apparently for fraud cases, the recommended sentencing rises exponentially as the amount of money does. So like if you commit huge fraud, then a lot of judges don't abide by the sentencing the sentencing recommendations because it's so much more time than it would be if you committed little fraud. I would say, though, that could have something to do with the demo that is most likely to commit large-scale fraud.
Right.
And that would be
rich white people.
Right. Exactly.
Correct. Yes.
People were pretty pissed.
They're really the only people who often have access to the opportunity to do
Correct.
Such a thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The lead prosecutor had tried to argue that this was an exceptional case because Manafort had committed so many different kinds of financial misdeeds. He had evaded $6 million in taxes, but had also been deceiving banks to get millions of dollars in bank loans. And bank fraud counts are the most serious counts that he was convicted of, and they carry a maximum penalty of 30 years in prison each. And he was convicted of two. But Judge Ellis thought that the guidelines were distorted, like we said, but he also said that he had recently sentenced another defendant who hid $200 million in overseas accounts and evaded $18 million in taxes to only 7 months. So, why go harder on Manafort, who's been involved in like treason, basically?
I was going to say, because he ruined America.
He ruined America.
That's why.
Exactly. As a side note, it doesn't seem unrelated that Judge Ellis is pretty incensed about the Mueller investigation. I'm mispronouncing a lot of words in this story. I'm having a hard time reading.
What's legal words?
I know. And he's like a hardcore conservative. So next week, there is a non-hardcore conservative judge sentencing Manafort for two conspiracy charges. And they think that she'll be a little bit more likely to give him time. But the problem is those conspiracy charges hold maximum sentences of 10 years or 5 years or something. So, there's just not as much time to even work with.
Well, maybe she'll try and make up for this sentencing.
Yeah, maybe. But there is a chance that they're going to let him serve some of these concurrently.
Oh, sure.
And they didn't, prosecutors hadn't taken a stand on that until this Judge Ellis sentencing came out, and then they said they might.
Yeah, boy.
So that's a mess.
Hey.
He can pray over a Trump signed Bible, is he?
Yes.
As he thinks about his fate.
Yes.
Because so there were tornadoes in Alabama last week. 23 people died.
Really,
they were bad tornadoes.
Yeah.
So Trump went down there on Friday to quote unquote comfort everybody.
Yes.
And during this trip, he naturally took some time to Sign some Bibles. As you do when you're definitely not the author of a book that has no real author anyway, but love to take credit for stuff.
What?
I
think we know who the author of the Bible is, Lila.
That's true. Brent knows who the author of the Bible is. I also know.
I don't, actually. Yeah.
I know who the author of the Bible is.
Well, sure.
It's people.
Correct.
It's a variety of people.
Yeah, some folks.
Some folks. Mm-hmm. Some of the people from history authored the Bible. Yeah. That's how all books got authored.
Yeah.
But so, in any case, apparently it started because a 12-year-old boy, this is apparently a thing with evangelicals, by the way, where they have people sign their Bibles. And so
I did not know that.
No. So a 12-year-old boy asked him, and then a 10-year-old asked him, and then Melania also got into the game. And then for a while, Trump is signing these Bibles. Apparently, Tim Tebow has been asked to sign Bibles. Like, a bunch of evangelical figures get asked to do this.
That's so weird.
Obama has done it. Here's what made Trump's different, though. Usually, when you're signing a book, you sign the inside page or whatever with your signature, say, to Timmy or whatever, whatever. Trump put a huge signature on the cover.
Well, his signature is the hugest signature of all time.
And he signed the cover of the Bible. So he basically added his name as the author of the Bible.
Oh, man.
Which is just too great.
I really did not know this was a thing until
I didn't either. Now. No, and so I read a bunch of articles that were incensed about it, and then I read one that was like, you guys, evangelicals are asking everyone to do this.
Weird. It's like their autograph book.
Yeah. No, it's, what's the most important book to you when you're an evangelical Christian? What else are you even allowed to read?
Well, I would contend that many of them are not reading that.
Well, clearly not, based on some of the positions that they seem to be holding as a result of their quote-unquote read of it. But what is your most prized possession as someone whose entire life revolves around the church?
Yeah.
That's your Bible.
Your Bible, I guess.
I once read a page of the Bible.
Sure.
It's very long, so I cut my losses and stopped there.
It's very long.
But I certainly don't have one around for signings.
No. I mean, I do, but I would never think to leave the house with it to have somebody sign it.
Well, I was thinking, if I knew that I needed a president to sign something, what would I ask? Like, maybe, not Trump, but maybe, a constitution or something?
I was going
to
say,
something appropriate to their position as the head of a state that is separate from...
Exactly. It just seems an odd thing to...
Right, I have a Bernie Sanders campaign sign still sitting in my living room. Like, I would have him sign that, I guess, if I needed him to sign. I don't need his signature for any purpose, but if I needed it...
Yeah.
That could be a thing.
But,
what a
world.
I usually don't ask anyone who's not the author of a book to sign it. Unless I'm writing a dedication to give it as a gift to someone else.
Right.
But you can't gift someone their own Bible.
No, you can't.
In any case. And then, in other tragic news for Donald Trump.
Oh, my gosh.
Him and Ann Coulter are now at war. The
Big
world
time.
Is upside down.
It really is. Yeah.
A lot has been going on that
this has, been
has made it
so. This for a while.
David Brooks is in favor of reparations right now. Literally the world is upside down.
It's so crazy.
But this story Yeah, it started, what, a few weeks ago, a few months ago?
Yeah, I think like back in middle part of February or something. Oh, yeah, it was around
the disaster declaration.
It was, right, exactly. Because Coulter said that that was a scam and basically was just like, you know, he's only doing it because he hasn't been able to like come through on his one campaign promise.
And she is very pro-wall, by the way.
Oh, she's so pro-wall.
She's more pro-wall than he is.
Yes.
More pro-wall than potentially anyone.
Yes. She's not afraid to tell you.
No.
The only thing she has also said that he's a gutless president. She's called him an idiot. And this is my favorite. In speaking about his State of the Union address, she said it was the lamest, sappiest, most intentionally tear-jerking State of the Union ever.
I mean, I
and
love
it. Was.
It. Yeah.
That's exactly what it was.
She's right.
Yeah.
Trump decided that, you know, announced a month ago that he never talks to her anyway.
Right. He said that she was, quote, off the reservation.
Yeah. Which.
But now, this weekend, he took to Twitter.
He's mad again.
And he's had it with her.
He's over Ann Coulter.
Called her a wacky nut job. I love this battle because it's just sort
it's
of like the, you really can't.
It's literal nonsense.
So, and it's, I mean, it's like, it's so hard to pick a side.
Oh, I know. And it's so nasty.
I know.
It's literally, though, it's like the presidency has devolved into two lunatics at a bus stop shouting insults at each other. You
totally.
Know? Like, it has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, no.
They're fighting about who's been more successful about advocating for a policy no one even wants that isn't going to work, that they can't get the money together to put together in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they're arguing about here.
Yeah.
It's like an argument about a meaningless thing.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, he said that she still hasn't figured out that despite all odds, I am winning on the border.
Oh.
How? What?
She wouldn't have been able to figure that out.
No, there's no way. There's no evidence that points to such a thing. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. If she had figured that out, I would request her to share with me.
I would be curious to hear what evidence she's referring to. You know? I mean, we have heard her speak many times because she comes to Politicon a lot.
Oh, she's a treat.
And every time that she comes, she makes bombastic statements about how important the wall is, or at least for the last few years.
Yes.
And we get to hear her explain why the wall is so important and why Trump is going to be great because of the wall.
Yeah.
And now everything has broken down. And the only person who I've ever heard advocate for the wall in person is Ann Coulter.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
Now that she's gone, like, who's left in that camp?
Yeah.
Who could possibly fulfill this dream of hers? First of all, like where does she go? Where does her support wander?
She could run for president.
I mean,
why not?
If Marianne Williamson can run for president,
right?
Ann Coulter can run for president.
That's right.
Ann Coulter is, I think, in many ways, like a better vehicle for the kind of like crazy ego driven nonsense that is the Trump world.
Totally.
You know, like she is a person who knows that she is saying bombastic things for no reason.
Oh, yeah.
She's in on the game. And she's
totally
that cynical
is.
That she doesn't care. I mean, she's that horrible of a person.
Yes.
But she is even more honestly distilling, like, shock politics.
Yeah, that's what.
Than
that's her game.
Anyone
has been for.
Has been ever.
Decades.
And.
That's her plan.
That's her plan. And so she is, like, she channels the rage better than he does in a lot of ways. But unfortunately, she's a woman, so she's never going to get the opportunities that he's gotten to do that on that scale. But, like. I have often thought that if in a world where Donald Trump is running for president, that like, what is Ann Coulter doing that she's not running for president?
Right?
I mean,
well, maybe she could run on the wall. I mean, there's going to be Bill Weld is running for president.
Exactly.
So there is a Republican primary coming in 2020. Yeah.
No, I mean, and this would be a treat.
So
if,
good.
If Ann Coulter tries to, because she gets play.
Oh,
you know, Bill Weld is just a nobody who's not doing anything. Ann Coulter is a media personality. She is the only person who works in the same field as Donald Trump, ultimately.
Yeah. Oh, my God. She should run.
She should run.
It
would be epic.
Get to her.
I mean, it would be horrible, but it would be epic. We can get to her because she fucking sits around in West Hollywood with her gaze, like, going to restaurants. She's always around here with, like, a gaggle of gaze.
Oh, yeah.
She gets spotted in restaurants around here all the time. That's how you know that her life is fake.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know? I mean.
Yeah. She's like besties with Bill Maher.
Exactly. Like that she's a dinner guest at too many West Hollywood area gatherings of people that would like to think they're real. So we could get to her if we needed to.
Yeah,
just FYI to everyone. We haven't figured it out yet, but if you want to tip us off, we're here for it.
Right. We'll find her.
We'll find her. But in any case, that's the news this
That's
week.
It.
Don't vote for Ann Coulter for president. Just because we want her to run. Don't vote for Donald Trump for president.
Well,
use good judgment.
True.
But that said, if we're going to live in a television era, Let's make it good television.
There it is.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.